This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is piano virtuoso Gary Graffman. Graffman had already performed for 30 years with orchestras around the world and had recorded with the top American orchestras when he lost control of the fourth finger of his right hand. By 1979, he could no longer play with his right hand. After Graffman made the rounds of top specialists who administered a battery of tests, his mysterious affliction was diagnosed. Doctors believe that his current muscle problems are the result of an injury he sustained years ago during a performance. The changes he made in his fingering to compensate for the injury only compounded the problem. Graffman is still in therapy, but is pessimistic about the likelihood of ever playing again with his right hand. In the last few years, he has rearranged his life. Now he teaches at the Manhattan School of Music and the Curtis Institute of Music, and he devotes more time to his other passion, collecting Oriental art. Graffman also wrote a memoir called I Really Should Be Practicing. Graffman hasn't given up playing. He's learning the small but challenging repertoire of piano concertos for the left hand, which he has been performing in concert. Before Graffman's right hand was disabled, he specialized in interpreting the works of the Romantic composers like Tchaikovsky, Brahms, and Rachmaninoff. This is his recording of Rachmaninoff's Prelude in G minor, Opus 23, No. 5.
Thank you.
That was Gary Graffman performing Rachmaninoff's Prelude in G minor, Opus 23, number 5. Graffman grew up in New York, where he was encouraged to play by his Jewish-Russian emigre parents. His father was an accomplished violinist who had directed the Imperial Conservatory in Omsk, Siberia. At age 8, Gary Graffman was enrolled in the Curtis Institute of Music. His performance career was launched when he won the 1949 Leventritt competition. I asked Gary Graffman when he first realized there was something wrong with his right hand.
To some extent, several years before I stopped playing, but I didn't realize how serious it was. I began to have problems with, a five-second passage in a Brahms concerto. Well, the octaves in the second movement. 10 seconds, maybe it is. And nothing else. Nothing else in the piece bothered me any more than it always did. I mean, it's a very difficult piece. And when I would mention it to colleagues, they didn't really take me seriously. I mentioned it to Rudolf Serkin, and he said, if that's the only thing that gives you problems in that piece, you're very lucky. Then Eugenie Stomin, who's a very close friend of mine, said, so you're getting older. And it was left at that. And each year I noticed, each year for the 3-4 years before I stopped playing, which was around 1980, I noticed another thing. Usually it was Brahms, as a matter of fact. I can think of something in the Brahms Handel variations and another in the Paganini. And didn't affect anything else. But then, like the straw that broke the camel's back, I guess it got 0.1% worse again. But this was the 0.1% of a percent that meant that instead of 10 seconds in a 40-minute piece, it maybe meant that there were 15 or 20 places. And that's when I stopped playing.
What did you do to compensate while that was happening?
I was refingering, playing octaves using my first and third finger, which, if you're playing fortissimo, is very effective. Not that I recommend it, by the way. And using the fourth finger less. Well, I guess because something was happening and I couldn't use it more. But when necessary, it was all right. But there was a point when it just didn't work anymore. And, the fourth finger droops in an extent when I'm in an extended position, like in an octave position. It's a problem that a few of my colleagues have. Leon Fleischer being the most, he's a very close friend of mine, and this had happened to him before, quite many years before it happened to me. And when it did happen to me, he was extremely supportive, and I guess he knew what I was going to be going through with doctors and so forth. A few days ago, I was in Boston, actually for a party, and I saw the doctors at Mass General because they had been treating me. And they told me that in the past year, they got 6 pianists, much younger than I am, in their 20s and 30s, who have almost identical problems to mine, which is weird. Why all of a sudden? There's a surgeon who also has this problem. It involves also the small muscles that are between the fingers of the hand, where some get weak, others are too strong, an imbalance.
Were the doctors able to tell you how you developed that condition?
They're not sure. I think I know how I developed it, and they pretty much agree with me. In 1967, I was playing with the Berlin Philharmonic on an absolutely dead instrument. I mean, you could hit it with a hammer, and it would sound rather pretty in a living room. But in a large hall with an orchestra, or against an orchestra, as it turned out to be, because I was pushing and in frustration and anger, I hit a note in the Tchaikovsky concerto with my fourth finger with such force that I injured my hand in the way that one does when one plays baseball. It's known as a baseball finger, actually, where the finger doesn't break. It just gets pushed in a little bit. The knuckle comes out a bit, and it's sprained, and it hurts for a few weeks, maybe 4 weeks, then gets better. I had this as a kid in both hands when I was playing baseball, and it did heal. And everything probably would have been fine if I had not decided, almost subconsciously, to protect my fourth finger a little bit because it had been injured, and start using the third in its place for these octaves, what happened was that it became such an almost infallible way for me to play octaves with tremendous strength, because the third finger is stronger than the fourth and fifth, that it became my normal octave fingering. And I had, when I was, some of my, I spoke to some colleagues who have no hand problems about this, and they tried it themselves just to see what I was talking about. And their hand hurt a little bit after that. And unfortunately, mine didn't. If it had, I probably would have stopped. I would have realized something was wrong.
Is there a music medicine, school of medicine that's growing, like sports medicine?
Yes. It's very new. The difference between sports medicine and music medicine, I mean, one of the main differences, is that sports medicine seems to involve the large muscles and music medicine, the very small muscles. Extremely. The ones that were, in my case, not even examined when I first started going to doctors. They're not necessary for life.
You must have had a lot of ideas in your head of what was wrong with you before you actually got a diagnosis that you could accept. Was what was actually wrong better or worse than what you imagined was happening to your body?
Well, what happened in my case was that the first doctors I went to, I hope, misdiagnosed it. No, they must have, because 4 or 5 years have elapsed now, where they thought it was a central nervous problem, such as Parkinsonism or this sort of thing, which would just continue to get worse and worse and worse and affect the rest of the body. So when it suddenly said, oh, no, it's not life-threatening, it's not the whole body, it's only your hand, it was almost a relief at that point.
When you stopped playing, did you go through a period of not wanting to go to concerts either or not wanting to listen to music?
No. No, I have actually many interests besides music. My whole life did change. Well, to start with, instead of playing 100 concerts a year, which was my average for like 20 years before this happened, I now play maybe 25 concerts a year, a repertoire for the left hand. Now, there isn't that much repertoire for the left hand, but I haven't learned all of it yet. I began to teach on a sustained level. I did teach a little bit before, and I had a few students, but they didn't. It was just for short periods of time. About 4 years ago, John Delancey at Curtis called me, and I'm deeply honored, actually, to be teaching at Curtis. I have five students there. And in addition, I have four students at the Manhattan School of Music in New York, which is where I live. And that's it. I mean, I don't teach anymore. I don't teach privately because I would rather, if I do have extra time, to give extra lessons to the students I already have.
When you were young, you studied with a Russian teacher.
With Isabel Vengerova. And I studied with her for the 10 years that I was at Curtis. And then I continued to play for her afterwards.
Did you have a Russian teacher because of your parents' Russian background? Did that have anything to do with it?
Yeah, actually. My father, who graduated from the Imperial Conservatory in Petersburg, St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, knew Vengerova, who was, at that time that he graduated, a very young teacher. She had just become a teacher there, having graduated herself from there. So when they all found themselves in New York, as so many of the Russians did at that time in the 20s, I know that my father played chamber music with her before I was born, so she was a friend of the family. In fact, I called her Aunt Bella.
Did she have a lot of things that she wanted you to conform to that you rebelled against?
Yes. But she was the kind of teacher, I guess, who realized that some things are more important than others. And although she, I guess, was upset that I didn't do certain physical things, I mean, just the way one bends one's wrist and relaxes at certain times and so forth, that she realized that was not the only way to play. And that's, I think, what's very important. Some teachers who are involved with methods Serkin is right and Horowitz is wrong, or Horowitz is right and Serkin is wrong. I mean, that, you know, they can't see that there can be as many approaches to a problem as there are great artists, and it's the end result that counts. She was mostly interested in beautiful sound. Well, we all are. So if she was satisfied that what I was getting out of the piano, which she wasn't always, but if she was, I guess she realized it was less important whether I was, you know, holding, you know, my hand in a certain position or not. But she studied with Leschetizky, who was one of the great teachers of all times. And he was a teacher, for example, of Schnabel, who was a completely different kind of pianist. Completely different. I mean, you think of him as a German. He was. After Vengerova, I studied with two other people. Well, one I really studied with, and that was Horowitz, who didn't even want to play for me so as not to influence me. Because if you're in your early 20s, late teens, early 20s, and you are under the influence of somebody like Horowitz, who anything he does sounds convincing, who plays so, you know, so fantastically, such a, you know, great sound, not to mention the technique and everything, he naturally would influence the student, perhaps in the peripheral things that he's doing, instead of the important ones. And he tried as much as possible not to play for me when he was criticizing what I was doing. In other words, not to show, here's how I do it, but he would discuss what I was trying to do or what he thought I was trying to do and how I could improve on my way of doing it.
You've given the acronym of OYAP to people who you describe as outstanding young American performers, and you were one of them.
That's what we were called. We didn't call ourselves that.
How did that name come about?
One of the managers at Columbia Management. Every one of us at that time with management, well, what does a manager do with a comparatively unknown pianist who did do something, won a competition, or played with a major orchestra, but, you know, that, and I was trying to promote him. So he's always called, you know, we're for next season, we're presenting so-and-so, the outstanding young American pianist. And we all were outstanding young American pianists. And as far as the managers, we felt that the managers really couldn't distinguish one of us from the other. And that's how it came. That's how it came up.
Since you won such a prestigious competition, the Levantrit, what do you think of competitions now? Do you think that they're the best way of establishing a career? And do you think that they're well judged and any kind of accurate measure of a young performer's talent?
Well, you can generalize. There are so many more competitions now than when I was growing up. Whether you like it or you don't like it, it's obviously perhaps the way that is used most. Well, let's work backwards. And if you take a list of pianists who are successful, and I'm talking about one generation, you know, younger than I am, people who are in their 20s, early 20s even, who are beginning to have what looks like the possibility of a career, as well as people in their 30s who've sustained it for a while, you will find that the vast majority of them, not all, but the vast majority, started their careers by winning a competition. So whether you like it or you don't like it, that is a way of doing it. It's very difficult otherwise, and it's not that different than a competition. With recommendations, a conductor will usually hear anybody. I mean, with good recommendations, if another artist... I asked Andre Previn to listen to this girl who played with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So he did, and he engaged her. But when she auditioned for him, she was one of many people who were auditioning for him during the period that he had time to hear people. So during a one-week period, maybe he heard, I don't know, 5 or 25 pianists and violinists and other people, and he engaged a very small number. So in a way, they were competing as well. So to say that you're not psychologically capable of playing in a competition, I don't think... I can see not wanting to play in a competition. I respect that. But to say that you don't do your best, well, you're competing all the time. I mean, you know. And if you're nervous about it, well, you'll also be nervous when you go out finally and play with the orchestra that that has engaged you. In my opinion, a competition is as good as its board of judges. In addition, the rules and regulations, if they are adhered to pedantically, it sometimes works against the competition. For example, some competitions have to give a first prize. Fine. Suppose one year there's a fantastic talent and he gets first prize, unanimous decision. The next year, there's no first-class talent, but very clearly one person, or not even very clearly, but one person is better than the second best, and maybe even by a 6-5 vote. He also gets first prize. That cheapens the prize. It makes it less valuable to the great talent who won it the year or 3 years before. Why give a prize? Why not say no prize? Which is, by the way, what the Levantrid used to do. On the other hand, suppose there are two superbly major talents, and the judges agree that if one of them didn't exist, the other would automatically get first prize. Then why not give two first prizes? Why push the other person down?
Speaking with pianist Gary Graffman, a lot of jazz pianists envy classical pianists in that they suspect the classical pianists are given much better pianos than jazz pianists are. Jazz pianists are frequently, when they arrive in town for a concert, presented a beat-up piano that hasn't been tuned in a couple of months. Does that ever happen to you when you're touring for a classical concert?
Well, wait, let's break this down. As I mentioned before, I haven't been playing that much in the last few years. But what I used to, it's a question of money. I used to bring pianos from New York, or a piano, obviously, from New York to cities that have good pianos, but not as good as the one that I'm bringing from New York. In other words, whenever I played with the Philadelphia Orchestra or Boston Symphony or Cleveland or Chicago, I would bring a piano from New York. And it cost a lot of money, and it costs even more now. But it was worth it to me. I felt I could have a better chance of, if I were inspired and if things were going well, it would be just that much better.
Wasn't there a concert you refused to perform in Brazil because of the quality of the piano?
Yeah, but that was more than that. It was also anger and amusement, both at the stupidity of the bureaucracy there. They had a very beautiful piano. But since the orchestra that I was playing with apparently hadn't paid its bill to the auditorium, they were not going to let the orchestra use the piano that was on stage, which was a very beautiful Steinway. And therefore, they had to ship in a piano of a different brand. And it wasn't so much even the brand. It also wasn't very good. I tried it. So I said, you work out your differences however you want. But the piano is there. It's on stage. They let me rehearse on it. They wouldn't let the orchestra use it for the concert, but yes, for the rehearsal. So the idea of rehearsing on one piano and playing in another, when that piano is still there, nothing happened to it, seemed like a bureaucratic problem, and I didn't want it to be my problem. So I said I wouldn't play, and they didn't believe me, and I didn't play. And as a result, I got very, very many letters of thanks from the local Brazilian pianists, who on their own couldn't have done that, because since they're local, nobody was listening to them. And it got into the papers, a lot more than if I had played the concert, obviously. And because of that, all sorts of rules and things were changed, and the person who was responsible was made to look like an idiot, which he was for this sort of thing. And it never happened again, I'm told.
The title of your memoir is I Really Should Be Practicing. How did you give your book that title?
I didn't. Eugenie Stoneman did. He came over, well, one of many times, and we showed him the chapter headings, and then we showed him the possible titles for the book. Some were proposed by Doubleday, some we proposed. Doubleday was not all that enthusiastic about the ones they proposed or the ones we proposed, and the same with us. I even forgot what they were. They were kind of bland. They were perfectly all right, some of them, but... And he was looking over the chapter headings. And one of the chapters, actually, was I Really Should Be Practicing. And he said, that should be the title of your book, because that sums up, you're always, whenever we try to get together. He says, I call you and say, let's meet for at 7:30 for dinner. And I say, no, I really should be practicing. Let's make it 8 or 8:30. So he actually chose the title.
Do you have that much pressure on you now to practice now that you're only doing left-hand pieces?
No, because I don't have that many concerts and I have very little repertoire. The amount of practicing, in my case, I guess in most people's case, have to do with repertoire. It isn't that I needed 6 hours on the Rachmaninoff concerto, but although I was playing the Rachmaninoff that night, 2 days later I was playing a Brahms concerto, and 2 days after that a recital, and then some chamber music, and then a piece I'd never played before. So I was, it was kind of trying to organize what I practice on which day. And probably had enough material to spend 12 hours day practicing on, so I'd have to make a kind of compromise.
Is it ever a relief to not have that in back of your head all the time, that idea that you really shouldn't be doing this, you should be practicing instead?
Yeah, some of my colleagues say that they're envious of me. I mean, they obviously are not really, but I must say that if I could press a button and turn the clock back, or rather have everything come back to normal, of course I would do it in as quickly as I could. But not having that option and not knowing what will happen, I must say that I'm not all that unhappy in my present state. I also have had the advantage over some of my colleagues of having played lots of concerts for 30 years. Because I mentioned I was playing like 100 a year for 20 years, and the 10 years before that I was playing a lot. I mean, so, I don't know, 50, 75, something like that. So I did play a lot. I made a lot of records with very great conductors. And I'm still playing to some extent, in a different way, of course. And I'm enjoying teaching because of the quality of the students, of course. I mean, I'm lucky in that. And I do have time to do other things besides music.
Do you know if your right hand will ever be able to play again?
I have no idea. I'm obviously not banking on it, but if... If any of Mass General's doctors, or for that matter, anyone else calls and says they have a new idea, of course, I'll let them try it.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was pianist Gary Grafman. Since his right hand was disabled, he's been learning and performing piano concertos for the left hand. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.